You are now listening to Jess's Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess's Lit. We are back with another episode of the sonnet series by Shakespeare. But before I move on to what we have to do for today, I just want to congratulate my younger brother, Jeff, on finally graduating his undergraduate at UBC. His graduation is today at 1:30, but I'd also like to congratulate all the graduating class of 2025 of this year, and hope all things go well for all of you guys and Jeff. So congratulations again, Jeff. I'll be attending his graduation actually after the show today, so I'm super excited, and my whole family here is on their way to the hall to attend as well, and so that's super exciting, and yeah, congratulations again to all of you guys. Today we are pretty packed with, of course, the sonnets, but before we get on to reading, we'll be starting 90. I read sonnet 90 for you guys last episode, but didn't analyze, and so today I'll be starting off 90. But before that, I have some ads, show promos, and PSAs with our first song of the day called Dreamcatcher by Onyx. So we'll be right back after these.
The world's most shocking monster.
That techno rock you guys listen to is gutless.
I'm sure.
And the only reason you don't understand our music is that you don't like it.
After I'm gone, your Earth will be free to live out its miserable span of existence.
Can anyone stop their mechanical mayhem?
All of my most sensitive areas were inflamed. My extremities pulsating with tingling sensation.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
Swaying back and forth. A beautiful thing taking me away.
You are a robot.
You must listen to Synaptic Sandwich, Saturday nights from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. on CITR FM 101.9.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at MasseyBooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's RIDEON Bike Shop. See you there.
Local voices matter. Yours, mine, the hosts on this community station. You know it, I know it. Now it's time for the government to support it. With your help, stations like this one will continue to do amazing things. It's called the Community Radio Initiative. Learn more at mycri.ca, and together we can make a difference for our community. Again, mycri.ca, because local voices are what shapes our neighborhoods.
Dear friends, allies, and advocates, between August 2022 and October 2023, the Drug User Liberation Front's Compassion Club and Fulfillment Center, DULF, CC, and FC, made history. As the first initiative of its kind, they offered a groundbreaking approach amidst an escalating overdose crisis in Vancouver's downtown Eastside. DULF has proved that a regulated drug supply isn't just a concept, it's a solution that saves lives. What's at stake? DULF co-founders Aris Nix and Jeremy Callicum are facing criminal charges under Section 5 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act for the compassionate and life-saving work of providing a regulated, predictable drug supply to some of the people most at risk from the toxic drug supply. They are now engaged in a legal battle to defend harm reduction, challenge outdated drug laws, and demand justice for those disproportionately affected by the toxic drug crisis. In order to pay for legal costs, they must raise $350,000 by October 1st, and they need your help.
You can donate directly now through e-transfer to druguserliberationfront@gmail.com. For more information and alternative ways to support, visit dulf.ca, D-U-L-F.ca.
Thank you.
And we are back. That was Dreamcatcher by Onyx. Sonnet 90 is where we will start today. Then hate me when thou wilt, if ever now. Now, while the world is bent my deeds to cross, join with the spite of fortune, make me bow, and do not drop in fore and after loss. Do not, when my heart hath scaped his sorrow, come in the rear ward of a conquered woe. Give not a windy night a rainbow rainy morrow to linger out a purposed overthrow. If thou wilt leave me, do not leave me last, when other petty griefs has done their spite. But in the onset come, so shall I taste, at first the very worst of fortune's might, and other strains of woe which now seem woe, compared with loss of thee will not seem so. So this, Sonnet 90, kind of continues from the final line of Sonnet 89, where it kind of begs the beloved to deliver quickly any terrible blow that awaits the poet. And the other blow kind of being dealt with by the world will seem as nothing. So moving on with lines 1 to 2, the phrase "then hate me when thou wilt" kind of sets up a conditional, where the speaker kind of concedes that hatred may come, but urges it to happen now, if it must. And the repetition of "now" is significant as it heightens the emotional urgency. The speaker is already facing opposition. We could see that in the phrase, "the world is bent in my deeds to cross," and that means that fate or fortune is currently against him. And we could also see that how he suggests that if you're going to hurt me, do it now while I'm already suffering, not later, when it will reopen a healed wound. Lines 3 and 4, here the speaker invites his beloved to add to his current misfortunes, in the phrase "join with the spite of fortune." And the phrase "after loss" implies a delayed blow coming after the main loss, which is more cruel. The speaker doesn't want a betrayal that arrives when he is finally recovering. So a little bit of what happens in lines 1 and 2. Lines 5 and 6, we get a continuation of the thought of "don't come after the sorrow has passed," adding new pain when the speaker believes the worst is over. The phrase "rearward" and "conquered woe" suggests a military metaphor, like a surprise attack after a battle has already been won, which is, in a sense, seen as cowardly and unfair. With lines 7 and 8, we are presented with another metaphor that adds a layer of emotional torment, where we could see it as "don't follow a stormy night with another miserable day." And we could see the phrases "windy night" and "rainy morrow" to be significant in this metaphor. The phrase "linger out a purposed overthrow" implies drawing out the speaker's emotional destruction, where he would rather have the pain be swift and decisive. With lines 9 and 10, the speaker fears being abandoned last, after already enduring a sequence of quote-unquote petty griefs, which are smaller pains and that have weakened him. This suggests a theme of emotional exhaustion, which is a final blow from the loved one would be disproportionately devastating. With lines 9 and 12, 11 and 12, the speaker urges that if you're going to hurt me, do it in the beginning. Again, kind of continuing this whole notion of hitting me last or making me suffer before the healing or the subsequent healing wounds, or the healing before is recovered in a sense. And so that the pain is front loaded and doesn't catch him off guard is what the speaker is kind of urging, And we could also see this as a plea for emotional clarity and control, where the phrase, let me suffer all at once, is kind of crucial in understanding this, rather than enduring or delaying the cumulative grief. The final couplet here delivers the emotional punchline, kind of solidifies the whole point of the poem, where the loss of the beloved will dwarf all other woes. And we could also see this as a comparative structure, where what now seems painful will seem insignificant in the face of that ultimate loss. The syntax here also mimics emotional confusion, in the phrases woe, which now seem woe, will not seem so, and that suggests that the speaker is already himself in turmoil. And that was Sonnet 90. We'll move on to Sonnet 91. Some glory in their birth, some in their skill, some in their wealth, some in their body's force, some in their garments, though newfangled ill, some in their hawks and hounds, some in their horse. And every humor hath his adjunct pleasure, wherein it finds a joy above the rest. But these particulars are not my measure, all these I better in one general best. Thy love is better than high birth to me, richer than wealth, prouder than garments cost, of more delight than hawks or horses be, and having thee of all men's pride I boast. Wretched in this alone, that thou mayest take all this away and me most wretched make. So in this sonnet, the poet sets the love of the beloved above every other treasure, but then acknowledges that the love can be withdrawn. We could see a bit of this in the lines 1 and 4, kind of cataloging the worldly sources of pride here. So we kind of list, the lines 1 and 4 list the traditional sources of status and pride kind of prevalent in the Elizabethan society, where the phrase birth refers to noble lineage, kind of the status one that is born into, and the phrase or the word skill might suggest artistic or intellectual or martial talent. The words wealth and the phrases bodies, force, and garments refer to material or physical assets. The phrase newfangled ill, in a sense, critiques superficial fashion, clothes that are trendy but of poor taste. The phrase hawks and bounds and horse allude to hunting and equestrian pursuits associated with the aristocracy. Now, to move on to a bit of technical terms, the anaphora in the phrase some kind of reinforces the variety and commonness of such worldly attachments. And that establishes them as external or somewhat hollow. And so we could see the slightly mocking tone in the quote-unquote newfangled ill, and how that hints, we could see that hints at the speaker's skeptical distance from these values. With lines 5 and 6, here the humor means disposition or temperament. And so we could see that Shakespeare references the belief in the four bodily humors governing personality. And this idea is that each person has a dominant inclination and therefore finds joy in a corresponding pursuit. With lines 7 and 8, we are presented with the Volta. The speaker rejects the catalog of prideful pursuits. Instead of valuing specific particulars, he values a quote-unquote general best, which is basically a universal good that surpasses all others, and in this sense, the love of the beloved. With lines 9 to 12, the speaker directly contrasts each previously listed source of pride with the beloved's love. The phrase better than birth implies love is a nobler status. The phrase richer than wealth, in a sense, alludes to the emotional wealth and how that exceeds material wealth. The phrase prouder than garments cost, here the love confers a pride that ultimately outshines vanity. And the phrase more delight than hawks or horses, we can see that the emotional joy is greater than recreational pleasure. And the line, and having thee of all men's pride I boast, suggests that his love gives him the right to claim the highest possible pride, surpassing everyone else's sources. And then the final couplet of this sonnet, we are presented kind of with the fragility of that boast, and we are introduced also with vulnerability. The speaker's joy and pride are entirely contingent upon the beloved's continued affection. Unlike wealth or birth, which cannot be taken away so easily, love is seen as unstable, and its loss would not only remove the speaker's source of pride, but cast him into utter misery. That was Sonnet 91. We'll move on to Sonnet 92. But do thy worst to steal thyself away, for term of life thou art assured mine, and life no longer than thy love will stay, for it depends upon that love of thine. Then need I not to fear the worst of wrongs, when in the least of them my life hath end. I see a better state to me belongs than that which on thy humor doth depend. Thou canst not vex me with inconstant mind, since that my life on thy revolt doth lie. Oh, what a happy title do I find, happy to have thy love, happy to die. But what so blessed fair that fears no blot? Thou mayest be false, and yet I know it's not. Now, continuing from the argument from the previous 91 sonnet, the poet, imagining the loss of the beloved, realizes gladly that since even the smallest perceived diminishment of that love would cause him instantly to die, and he need not fear living with the pain of loss. And however, he asks, what if the beloved is false but gives no sign of defection? And so we will kind of dig deep into this question here. Lines 1 and 2, the speaker dares the beloved to try and leave, but asserts a kind of emotional or spiritual possession. For the duration of life, the beloved is assured mine. And so we can see a tension between agency and possession here. With lines 3 and 4, the speaker's life is conditional upon the beloved's love. If the beloved's love dies, so too will does the speaker, whether emotional or emotionally or literally, is left open. With lines 5 and 6, these two lines kind of play on scale and proportion, where even if the least betrayal by the beloved ends the speaker's life, then the worst wrongs hold no further terror. And so this logic is in a sense paradoxical. There's comfort in knowing that even the smallest loss of love will be fatal, so there's no need to further harm or fear further harm. And so it kind of gestures towards a stoic acceptance of love's risks. Lines 7 and 8, the speaker claims a better state, perhaps spiritual or eternal, that does not rely on the beloved's fickle humor, kind of mood or whim. With lines 9 and 10, even if the beloved is inconsistent, the speaker won't be vexed because the stakes are total and the speaker's life ends with any betrayal. With lines 11 to 12, this exclamation brings an ironic twist, where the speaker finds joy both in possessing the beloved's love and in the possibility of death if that love is lost. The final couplet, we are kind of injected with doubt and fragility here, where even the most blessed fair things are not immune to blot, which is implied stain and corruption. And so the speaker acknowledges a terrifying possibility where the beloved may already be false, and he is ignorant of it. As a bigger picture, we could see that love is vulnerable to deception and trust may be misplaced. And so that was Sonnet 92. Before we move on to Sonnet 93, I have one more song to play for you guys. And it is called Purpose by John Easton. So we'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
We are back. That was Purpose by John Easton. Moving on to 93. So shall I live supposing thou art true, like a deceived husband, so love's face may still seem love to me, though altered new, thy looks with me, thy heart another place. For there can live no hatred in thine eye, therefore in that I cannot know thy change. In many's books the false heart's history is written, moods and frowns and wrinkles strange, but heaven in thy creation did decree that in thy face sweet love should ever dwell. Whatever thy thoughts or thy heart's workings be, thy looks should nothing thence but sweetness tell. How like Eve's apple doth thy beauty grow, if thy sweet virtue answer not thy show. So in Sonnet 93, the poet explores the implications of the final line of Sonnet 92, where it would be easy for the beloved to be secretly false, but he realizes because the beloved is so unfailingly beautiful and apparently loving. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker opens with an uneasy premise where he will live supposing his beloved is true, which already suggests a lack of trust. The comparison to a deceived husband is, in a sense, loaded, where such a man continues in his role and affections unaware of betrayal. And so the simile sets a tone for self-deception or reluctant acceptance, which is a theme that will, or that kind of pervades the whole poem. Lines 3 and 4, the appearance of love continues to seem real, even if it has changed in essence. The lover may act the part, but emotionally she is elsewhere. Shakespeare here highlights the surface-level illusion, and that's pretty apparent in this poem, where the outward signs of affection can persist even as the internal truth has shifted. With lines 5 and 6, these lines reflect the speaker's helplessness, whereas he cannot confirm her betrayal because her eyes, or the supposed windows to the soul, betrays nothing. Her face, particularly her eyes, remain soft and loving, which creates a sense of an epistemological problem, or a question. This question kind of arises where how can one know truth if the body lies? It's a very deep epistemological question there that is worth, of course, to consider. With lines 7 and 8, by contrast, most people betray their inner selves through their facial expressions, and their quote-unquote false heart's history is readable in signs like frowns or odd wrinkles, and these physical cues usually reveal the truth, but not in the beloved's case. Lines 9 and 10, we are introduced with the idea of the divine design. God or nature made her such that her face must always express love regardless of what she feels inside. And so this implication is that her beauty is inherently misleading, making her incapable of visibly reflecting unfaithfulness. With lines 11 to 12, these lines reinforce the paradox where her internal state is inaccessible no matter how she feels or what she does. Her appearance projects constancy and affection. The final couplet kind of drives the point home, where the beloved's beauty, like Eve's apple, is dangerously deceptive. And the reference to Eve conjures temptation, sin, and the fall, where if her virtue doesn't match her appearance, then the beauty is not only false, but actively destructive. Moving on to Sonnet 94. The net of power to hurt and will do none, that do not do the thing they most do show, who, moving others, are themselves as stone, unmoved, cold, and to temptation slow. they rightly do inherit heaven's graces and husband nature's riches from expense. They are the lords and owners of their faces, others but stewards of their excellence. The summer's flower is to the summer sweet, though it to itself it only live and die. But if that flower with base infection meet, the basest weed outbraves his dignity. For sweetest things turn sourest by their deeds, lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds. The sonnet kind of describes the category of especially blessed and powerful people who appear to exert complete control over their lives and themselves. And so with lines 1 to 4, we kind of get a description of a kind of ideal person, someone who has great power to hurt or act, but chooses restraint. The first line introduces a paradox, power without action, how these people could do harm but don't. And lines 2 plays with the appearance versus reality and how they seem capable of action but refrain also. Lines 3 and 4 emphasize their emotional impassivity, where they can move others emotionally or through influence, but are themselves cold as stone. With lines 5 to 8, these lines kind of praise the self-controlled, and we can see these in the phrases heaven's graces, where the divine virtues they inherit rightly because of their restraint. And they are masters of themselves also, in the phrase lords and owners of their faces, and that implies that they control even their external expressions, unlike others who are mere stewards, temporary caretakers of their own beauty or virtue. With lines 9 and 12, the summer's flower is sweet and admired, but fleeting and unaware of its own significance. And if it becomes corrupted, even the ugliest weed can seem more dignified than the now degraded flower. The final couplet kind of encompasses the whole poem, where the greater initial virtue or beauty, the worse the fall when it's corrupted. And the main passage, or the main point in a sense, could be summarized as moral failure in the virtuous is more appalling than vice in the base. And so that kind of sums up Sonnet 94. Sonnet 95. How sweet and lovely dost thou make the shame, which like a canter in the fragrant rose doth spot the beauty of thy budding name. Oh, in what sweets dost thou thy sins enclose, that tongue that tells the story of thy days, making lascivious comments on thy sport, cannot dispraise but in a kind of praise, naming thy name blessed in ill report. Oh, what a mansion have those vices got, which for their habitation chose out thee, where beauty's veil doth cover every blot, and all things turns to fair that eyes can see. Take heed, dear heart, of this large privilege, the hardest knife ill-used doth lose his edge. And so this poem, the poet accuses the beloved of using beauty to hide a corrupt moral center. With lines 1 to 4, the speaker opens with a paradox. Shame becomes sweet and lovely in the beloved's presence. And this suggests that the addressee has such beauty or charm that even their faults seem attractive. The metaphor of the canker in the fragrant rose, refers to a worm or disease that corrupts the rose from within. And ultimately, this highlights the idea that despite outward beauty implied by the rose, inner corruption or shame kind of mars it. And the final line of this quatrain kind of deepens the paradox before, where sin is hidden inside sweets, and that kind of means that the beloved cloaks vice as an attractiveness. With lines 5 and 8, the speaker reflects on how people talk about the beloved's life, lascivious comments on thy sport. That phrase implies that the beloved's actions are seen as sexually wanton or morally questionable. However, even in gossip or scandal, the tone remains admiring, and the phrase cannot dispraise but in a kind of praise suggests that even criticisms are laced with admiration. With lines 9 to 12, we could see that vice is personified as choosing to live in the beloved, and that suggests that this person has become a dwelling place for sin. And the use of mansion implies that these vices have found luxurious, comfortable lodging, hinting that the beloved enables, or also, in a sense, welcomes vice. Now, the final line here is significant, where the line, all things turn to fair that eyes can see. This phrase implies a dangerous subjectivity where the visual and therefore superficial overrides truth or morality. The last couplet, we get a shift from observation to a direct warning. And so the phrase take heed suggests that the beloved must be wary of abusing the privilege of being beautiful and admired. And so the overall implication is that while beauty now protects and accuses vice, the shield is not eternal and will not be eternal. And over time, continued moral failure will degrade the advantages of beauty and what beauty confers. And so that was Sonnet 95. Moving on to Sonnet 96. Some say thy fault is youth, some wantonness. Some say thy grace is youth and gentle sport. Both grace and faults are loved of more and less. Thou makest false graces that to thee resort. As on the finger of a throned queen, the basest jewel will be well esteemed. So are those errors that in thee are seen, so truths translated and for true things deemed. How many lambs might the stern wolf betray, if like a lamb he could his looks translate? How many gazers mightest thou lead away, if thou wouldest use the strength of all thy state? But do not so, I love thee in such sort, as thou being mine, mine is thy good report. And as in the companion of Sonnet 95, kind of to see Sonnet 95 as a companion, the beloved is accused of enjoying the love of many despite his faults, which youth and beauty convert to graces. And so in lines 1 and 2, these two lines kind of set up a dialectic where people are debating whether the speaker's beloved is guilty of indiscretions or merely charming innocent. And the word some here introduces ambiguity and plurality of opinion, suggesting that the beloved's actions invite varied interpretations. With lines 3 and 4, well, to kind of add more with lines 1 and 2, this kind of framing of these interpretations underscores the tension between appearance and moral reality. With lines 3 and 4, we kind of turn to the social perception of the beloved, where both virtues and vices, seen as grace and faults, attract love from people across the spectrum. And to be more provocative, the beloved has the uncanny ability to transform faults into graces, either through charm or beauty, so that even misdeeds seem admirable. With lines 5 and 6, we are presented with a simile and how it draws a vivid image where a cheap jewel gains valuable value merely by being worn by a queen. And so this compares to the beloved, who can make even base qualities seem noble. And so we could also see an implicit warning here about the illusion of status and association, where what is on the outside or associated with beauty can seem more valuable than it is. With lines 7 and 8, the completeness of the simile is presented. Just as the queen's jewel is elevated, so are the beloved's flaws is mistaken for virtues. And so the beloved's errors are rebranded as truth, indicating the power of perception shaped by love or beauty. And the idea of translation here underscores the fluidity of moral judgment and how flaws are not erased, but misinterpreted. With lines 9 to 10, here the metaphor becomes darker, where a wolf in lamb's clothing. And this rhetorical question kind of critiques the deceptive appearance and their consequences. And it suggests that the beloved could lead the innocent astray, not necessarily through intent, but through the seductive misreading of appearances. Lines 11 to 12, these lines kind of develop the scene and theme of seductive power. If the beloved were to fully wield his beauty and charm, he could mislead many. And so again, the idea is that the outer beauty can manipulate or overpower inner truth. With the final couplet, we are ending with a personal plea. The speaker warns the beloved not to abuse his power. And the final lines turn inward, emphasizing a possessive and perhaps a conditional love, where the beloved's reputation reflects on the speaker. The phrase, "Mine is thy good report," suggests that the speaker's own honor is tied to the beloved's behavior. And so this kind of unifies and anchors the poem's abstract moral and aesthetic concerns in the concrete reality of reputation and intimacy. And so that was Sonnet 96, and we have also come to the end of the episode today. We kind of went over six beautiful sonnets, 90 to 96, and we'll be kind of doing continuing off 96 the next episode. But that is the end. Again, I would like to deeply congratulate the graduating class of 2025 for UBC, and again to my brother Jeff for finishing his Bachelor of Arts. Congratulations, brother. He will be, and I'm super glad to say this, he is and super proud to say that he will be starting his MJ, Master of Journalism at UBC, the best journalism program in Canada, starting this fall. And so congratulations on your graduation of your undergrad, and congratulations on getting accepted into the journalism program here at UBC this fall. Thank you all for joining Jess is Lit. I will see you guys again next week with more Shakespeare sonnets. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Thank you. Bye-bye. Sangoto sikoyo, beri samoto sikoyo, sikoyo, sikoyo.